hello everybody and welcome back to another episode of the Flicks the Church Forgot. My name's Peter Laws, and if you're joining me for the first time, this is a podcast that explores horror movies and the potential spiritual and theological themes found therein. And weirdly enough, horror can touch on a lot more spiritual themes than you initially might think, even in the most grotesque of movies. Now tonight we're going to be looking at a sometimes misunderstood and I would say unfairly maligned movie, Day of the Dead from 1985. But before then, just to mention, you can join the conversation, as they say, at the Flicks the Church Forgot Facebook page, or you can follow me on Twitter at Rev Peter Laws. And I guess as an aside, I'd mention that the Twitter account is the most frequently updated one, because I guess that's more of a general, sometimes more personal one. So that covers things more than just horror. Okay then, well, enough chit-chat for now. Just come with me into the lift, or perhaps you prefer to call it the elevator. And yes, you're right, those buttons there do indeed show minus numbers, because we are going down, deep, deep down into the third of George A. Romero's zombie franchise, Day of the Dead.
First came the night, then came the dawn. Now comes the most eagerly awaited day in horror film history. George A. Romero's Day of the Dead.
We've been punished by the Creator. He visited a curse.
Hello! Is anyone there?
For the few remaining, their only hope of survival is to find a cure.
You're wasting time trying to define what's happening.
But the odds are against them.
We're in the minority now. Something like 400,000 to one by my calculations.
And so is Captain Rhodes.
Anybody else have any questions about the way things are gonna run around here from now on?
Their one chance is Bub.
It's working on instinct. A deep, dark, primordial instinct.
But their time is running out.
They can be fooled, don't you see? They can be tricked into being good little girls and boys, the same way we were tricked into it, on the promise of some reward to come.
But when the tricks wouldn't work...
They're actually learning.
Their world fell apart.
Very nice at all. You can just sit there in the dark, think about what you've done. Think about it. Think.
The dead shall have their day. Day of the Dead.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
There's a documentary about Day of the Dead, which crops up on some of the special editions of the film. I forget which edition it is, but I do remember the first words, pretty much, that are spoken in it. George Romero crops up on the screen and he says something like, there's so many fans of Dawn of the Dead and there's many people who really are into Night of the Living Dead, but then there are these odd little trolls who seem to love the movie Day of the Dead. And I think that's the perfect summing up of the third entry into Romero's zombie series. His first two movies made such a huge commercial and critical and cultural impact, and yet the third film was unliked or even hated by many moviegoers and critics. You can read some of the original responses to the film online, and people just ripped it apart. They said it was boring and too shouty, that it had terrible acting, and weirdly, that it had no story to it. But let me just raise my zombie hand up nice and high, high enough for you to be able to see and to mark me down. I am one of those odd little trolls who happens to love this film. And I'm not surprised that Romero himself says it's his favorite of the zombie films that he made. And while I love Night of the Living Dead, and I really adore Dawn of the Dead, I think in some ways Dawn of the Dead is one of the most perfect films that's ever been made. But I think Day of the Dead is an underloved, undervalued little gem. One of the many things I like about Romero's zombie movies, and I guess I'm going to have to be frank with you, when I'm thinking about that, I am sort of thinking about the first three. Maybe I'm a bit too retro for my own good, but that's what I'm talking about. I love them because they don't particularly follow the same characters. The recurring hook of these films, and certainly all the rest of the ones that he did, is not so much about people, but it's about a situation. It's about the end of the world and the horrifying phenomenon of dead corpses rising to life. Now, Romero understood very early on that it was this situation, that was the real connector, rather than any particular set of characters, which is in some ways quite unusual in film and fiction. I've read plenty of advice on both novel and film writing that say the true key to lasting film franchises or whatever is a focus on strong characters that move throughout from story to story. Hence, we have the James Bond films or horror franchises like Friday the 13th or the Elm Street movies, where there's this sense of longevity, and it's mainly due to a character that audiences connect with so much. They follow that into multiple sequels. And the equivalent happens a lot in crime fiction with authors 10, 20 books in about the same person going through new adventures. It's almost really, I think, crime fiction is like the episodic TV shows of the 70s and the 80s. But Romero does something different here because he knew that it was the situation that was the real draw here. And so in each film, he moves his lens to new characters and new settings, all within the same global crisis. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that these films don't have good characters in and of themselves. I mean, particularly Day of the Dead has some great characters, which we'll explore in a moment. But I'm saying the success of the zombie franchise is not about character, it's about situation. And that's obviously one of the reasons why the zombie movie genre has exploded as it has, because it's almost like an untrademarked palette or idea that can be translated into multiple different stories, and indeed has done just that. With Night of the Living Dead, which really does deserve its status as a game-changing horror movie, Romero showed how a few scattered people coped with this in a single farmhouse. In Dawn of the Dead, he threw the scope a far wider to see how some friends cope with the zombie apocalypse while holding up not only in a shopping mall, but also in the wider world, since a decent proportion of that film does take place in the city and then the countryside, so it's not just all about the shopping mall, as a lot of people seem to think. It's probably why the film has such an epic feel to it, because it's got a bunch of stuff before the mall as well as the mall itself. So while Night of the Living Dead had a small focus and Dawn of the Dead had a relatively wide focus, we find that Day of the Dead was Romero pulling the focus back to small again. Now, it has to be said that this was not necessarily something he desired or was his original intent. He actually planned on a very ambitious production that he famously described as saying would be the Gone with the Wind of zombie movies. But sadly, the jumpy financiers refused to back such an ambitious project unless he dropped it to an R rating. And even then, they were worried his original epic script may simply be too expensive to film. And so, with a budget slashed, he forced himself to go back to small again, and he uses the opportunity to explore a completely new thematic angle in this episode or this segment. And in many ways, I think he plumbs some much darker and more abstract and profound themes. Now, after an iconic opening sequence with the main heroine touching a wall of zombie hands bursting through it was used in the teaser trailers, the film moves into a brilliant extended credits sequence with a helicopter searching the Florida coast looking for signs of life, for supplies and survivors, but they find nothing at all. Inside are a group of people who, in the zombie-free America of previous time, would have been classed as minorities. A black Jamaican called John McDermott, who's an Irish drunken radio engineer, a nervous Hispanic soldier with some religious tendencies called Miguel, and a woman from the Doom sequence we see at the beginning who's called Sarah. She's the heroine and is also a scientist. We'll talk much more about her a bit later, and particularly in the next episode of this series of looking at Day of the Dead. And one of the crew, anyway, when they're in the helicopter, he says that they have to set this down in the city, and John the Jamaican pilot says, and you're going to have to forgive my accent, right? But I know so much of this film off by heart, I can't resist doing it. So at the beginning, he says, I'll set us down, but I won't leave my seat, and I'll keep the engine running. Now, the first sign of trouble, I'm going up. If you ain't on board when that happens, you're likely to have a lousy afternoon. I'll tell you right, forgive my awful accent there, but that stuff, particularly his speeches and his big speech in the middle, we'll talk about that later, is etched on my memory. Anyway, they sat down in a deserted street and there's alligators roaming about, which apparently suggests that the zombie disease hasn't affected wildlife in the same way, unless that's a zombie alligator. I guess it's a bit hard to tell. But if I was a scientist, I may be tempted to chuck one of those gators in the back of the helicopter to work out what's going on with the animals. But anyway, they don't do that. Miguel, instead, the Hispanic guy, starts shouting, you know, is there anybody there? Hello? Hello? The response is something along the lines of... camera starts moving to various zombies waking up and moving towards the sound. And there's a brilliant little moment in this opening sequence where a newspaper flutters through the wind and slides up against a litter bin, and it shows the headline, "The Dead Walk." I love that bit. I remember seeing that for the first time and just thinking about all that had gone before in the previous two films, and it chilled me when I saw that. It's like the echo of a time between Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, when people were just becoming aware that old Granny Bertha, who they buried last week, is probably going to be scratching at the windows, hungry for skin tonight. And so that dead walk little bit at the beginning has that sense of people trying to get their heads around it. But now those newspapers are scattered on the floor because it's fallen into hell-like chaos. And as the zombies start stirring, we see one of the first noticeable differences between Day of the Dead and two of the films that preceded it, the makeup. Whereas most of the zombies in Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead had sort of pale skin, in Dawn of the Dead they had sort of electric blue hue, and they had minimal, if any, prosthetics, although there's a few prosthetics in Dawn of the Dead. It seems like Day of the Dead, all of the zombies are feature zombies with horrific wounds and disgusting dripping fluids. Apparently the zombie extras got paid $1 each and were given a hat that said, "I was a zombie in Day of the Dead," and I bet not a single one of them felt shortchanged by that deal. But we'll talk more on Tom Savini's amazing makeup effects later. Anyway, the guys realize that things around here are not going to go and work out so well, and so they rush back to the helicopter and fly back home. Now, this entire opening sequence, I've talked about it at length because I think it works very well, because I feel it is a trick. We see bright, sunny images of a ravaged and zombie-strewn landscape. It's colorful, vast, and filled with space. And you get the sense of wind and air, which might be filled with a putrid stench of decay, that's true, but there's still a sense of, like, there are the elements are still at work. They continue on, despite the hideous calamity that's befallen the Earth. And you think, okay, right, I get this. Now I know why this is called Day of the Dead. This is going to take place in the harsh, open light. Yet for a film called Day of the Dead, the opener is filled with false promises. Because the day that Romero has in mind isn't going to take place in the way the title suggests. It's not going to be a day in the sun, but rather in the dark shadows of an underground storage facility. A cave, pretty much, which is the home these people have found themselves having to live in. Romero's idea of a day, therefore, is the deep, airless black. I love the way he deals with his budgetary cuts by simply going in the opposite direction. So we find our guys returning to the underground base, which is called the Seminole Storage Facility. Got to try and find a t-shirt with that on. And they find the previous commander, Major Cooper, is dead. The base isn't exactly teeming with human survivors as it is, and so that means now they're down to four from the helicopter, another two scientists, and I think seven soldiers. One of which has assumed command and is the formidable and plainly psychotic Captain Rhodes, which is played with scary energy by Joe Pulido. And so we have this setup for a really interesting exploration of the grand zombie world setting, only in a cramped and claustrophobic hole of a place. And ironically, this setting is like a bizarre flip reversal of how life had been before the zombie apocalypse. The world really has been turned on its head, where the dead can walk free above, around, in the sun, while the human beings are forced to live literally in dark tombs underground. The dead, as the previous film so chillingly prophesies, really have inherited the earth in Day of the Dead. And there's a bunch of interesting new angles that Romero takes with this entry, and perhaps the most prominent is the idea of scientific research into the zombie virus, and the seeking after not just a cure or immunity drug, but of the idea of even domesticating the zombies, of training them not to eat brains. I love these sorts of ideas because it shows you that Romero and his colleagues have probably sat down over a beer and really discussed the implications of this fictional scenario, and they were doing this long before it became in vogue. I mean, if dead bodies really did come alive, then the reactions, I think, would be very similar to the trajectory that we feel and see in the first three Romero zombie films. The first stage, if it actually happened in this world, I think would be confusion and disbelief, and that's exactly what you see in Night of the Living Dead. It encapsulates the chaos, the bewilderment of that situation happening. People are just saying, what is this? Oh, let's just call them ghouls. We don't know what the heck this is, what's going on here. And the next stage would be a realization of what would be happening around us, but that would lead to panic and the need for escape. And that's what Dawn of the Dead is all about, where people are on the run. They know what is happening in the world because the TV stations are talking about nothing else, but you just have to run for your life. And yet there's still a feeling of the old world is desirable and maybe salvageable. And the third stage would be a sort of depressed acceptance, and then an attempt to deal with it, an attempt to try and fix it. And that's where Day of the Dead steps in. Spearheading this idea of scientific research is the kooky Dr. Logan, also known as Dr. Frankenstein, played with, okay, a little bit of an over-the-top campiness by Richard Liberty, but I still think he was great. I think he's really good value in this. And he plays the part of, the full-on crazy hair mad scientist, and in some ways he reminds me a little of a crazy unkept version of Herbert West from H.P. Lovecraft's Reanimator story. This sort of relentless quest to bring some life to the dead. For West, it was bringing life itself to an inanimate corpse. But for Logan, his is a little bit more nuanced. It's bringing civilized life, because the dead walking is as commonplace now as the wind on the sea. It just happens all around people. So he has a rather more difficult and challenging sort of anthropological task of trying to get these zombies to behave themselves. And so when Sarah, the heroine, and also a scientist herself, goes to see Logan at the start, she learns that he's isolated a part of the zombie brain that can cause antisocial behavior in zombies, and zombies are incredibly antisocial. And presumably, it's that part of the brain that gets destroyed in the classic shoot-them-in-the-head approach to zombie survival tactics. So Logan is showing off his grisly experimentation with some amazing makeups of headless corpses and twitching spinal cords with sort of like scissors hanging off them. But the problem is Sarah spots a uniform on the floor and realizes poor old Major Cooper is the body on the table. Dr. Logan is clearly pushing the laws of medical ethics in this work, and if he gets found out by Rhodes, the new leader, and the men, he will be killed. So this is setting up this other major theme of the film. That's the tension between the military and the scientific community. So that we have frequent arguments, and yes, loud shouty ones, about the best way to deal with dwindling supplies and seeking out more survivors. At one point, even, one of the arguments gets so heated that Rhodes commands his man Steel. And I like the character of Steel. He's a good laugh, but he's also brutal and hard. He commands Steel to pull a gun on Sarah, the scientist, who has threatened to walk out. They think, at first, it's a joke, but then Rhodes is like, "Get back in your chair, or by God, I'll have you shot." It's like, oh, hang on a minute, things have got bad. Especially when the soundtrack is going, you know, military action to the max. And then there's this constant sense of tension going on, which is ultimately a tension born out of fear and stress at the situation they find themselves in. You cannot blame these people for shouting at each other and freaking out, because the gradual crumbling of previously held orders and command are happening all around them. In a sense, it's stated in the film, the military are in that storage cave to facilitate the scientific work. But as time goes by and there seems to be no messages from HQ anymore, no mandates, the military men are perhaps understandably thinking, it's probably time to make up our own mission brief. Yeah, I suppose you could say that the groups are painted a bit one-dimensionally. I can see why people would think that at first. I don't think it's true, but I think I can see what they mean. In a sense, the military are these aggressive, seemingly unenlightened and unscientific brutalists. But I do think there are moments when you see a depth to them. For example, in the scene I just mentioned where Rhodes orders Steel to shoot Sarah, he's all bravado, Steel is, and threats, and he's like, yeah. But then he just thinks it's a joke, and he holds out his finger as a gun, and he says, bang, you're dead. But then Rhodes pulls a gun on him and says, shoot that woman or you're dead. And you can see Steel isn't comfortable with this, but he has to do it. This is his commanding officer saying it. So it's like they're living up to the stereotype of being all bravado, but then this situation is forcing them to actually be like that. And also Rhodes may be a full-on military man, but he's still, I think at times at least, willing to consider the views of the scientists, or particularly when they are articulated by Dr. Logan or Dr. Frankenstein, who can sort of whirl them around his little finger, as I think one character says, or says something like that. but also the scientists themselves are not just glasses-wearing oddbods who are seeking out a purely rational response to the crisis. Logan in particular is really, he's like just this brilliant man who has found himself going insane with the situation he's in. And there's hints that he is regressing back to his childhood somehow, and that probably had some sort of weird abusive childhood when he was forced to do the right thing. And he's repeating this with the zombies. That's an interesting backstory, I think, that's hinted at. But because he's going insane, he's using the scientific language of his training to help keep him from collapsing completely. But in time, science and his own madness, destined to collide, and they do quite spectacularly in this. But for me, one of my favorite characters in Day of the Dead is Sarah, played, I think, brilliantly by Laurie Cardell. She genuinely cares about finding solutions for this nightmare the world has found itself in. But she also keeps saying how it would be better for them all if they could work together. She's got this no-nonsense, badass approach to life. She's not just some meek, mild scientist who doesn't want to see the military's point of view. She can, in a sense, empathize with them at the same time as being exasperated with their approach. But also, she's an incredibly strong female character, and I'd like to talk about that more in the next episode, because we're going to analyze the film's themes in a bit more depth, and her character is really key to one of the discussions there. So we'll hold off on Sarah, or Laurie Cardell, for a moment for now. So anyway, you have these two groups, the scientists and the military, getting more and more at each other's throats, and so it's no surprise, perhaps, to see two civilians on the base. They prefer to keep themselves well away. This is where we get the two, if you will, normal people of the piece. Normal as in they're not scientists, they're not military. One is the Jamaican pilot John, and the other is the whiskey sniffing Irishman McDermott. Now, McDermott sounds like a Scottish name to me, but anyway, not to worry. They have this habit of holding up their hands, really, and saying, "Hey, it's not my problem," when the two camps start arguing with one another, and they even go so far as physically removing themselves from the central accommodation of the base. In fact, they seem to be the only people on the base who are interested in utilizing the wealth of items that are stored in this big facility. They live in this RV out in the caves of this place, and when Sarah goes out there to give them a hard time for being so laissez-faire about everything, at first she actually becomes quite softened and touched at the fact that they have tried to rebuild a bit of humanity down there. Unlike the harsh lab space of the main base, the RV has mood lighting and hanging trinkets. Ornaments are there purely for aesthetic purposes. You know, they're not just there as test tubes that need to be used for a practical purpose. And there's pictures on the walls, not just charts and graphs and records. I think, if I remember rightly, there's even a sign that says, "God bless this house," or something. They've got plants and deck chairs, and they lounge around drinking alcohol. They're sort of just kicking back a little bit from the situation. And at first, I remember when I watched this for the first time, I really sympathized with Sarah. I was thinking, these guys are just like, they're being lazy. You know, they just don't give a damn about trying to fix this world situation. But then you start to see that what they're doing out there is something that you can understand. And reflecting on it now, I feel like they tell us, these two reactions, that there are two ways of surviving a hideous trauma. One, if you go through an awful situation, you can have this relentless drive to fix the situation. And that's admirable and sometimes quite right. And in their own way, the military and the scientists are doing that. They want to relentlessly fix this situation. But what the two civilians are doing, particularly John, are saying that these people who are trying to fix this and this situation are in total denial. The only option is to admit defeat, to retreat, and to start again. His point is that there's no shame in doing that, and maybe that's all they have left. It's this scene in the RV that has a great speech from John as well about the pointlessness of what they're all trying to do, of hanging on to the past when you have to let go. And I think, oddly, it's a message to anyone who's been through hard times. Maybe the loss of a loved one, the knowledge of being, you know, being given a diagnosis of ill health, of getting older, or getting an old, like, elderly or something, and looking back on a time of saying, "Oh, how can I remake what once was? How can we get back? We must get back, relentless." And then a point comes when you can reach a place where you'll think, back there doesn't exist anymore. Maybe you're better off just moving into a new world. Even though the new world pales in comparison from what once was, everything's changed, and you might as well get used to what's in the future. It's a pretty deep message, and ultimately, in a sense, it's John's message that makes the most sense in one sense in this story. So he gives this speech, I'm not going to embarrass myself by doing the whole thing, but I can pretty much do the whole thing. There's a whole bit where he goes like, there's a great big 14-mile tombstone with an epitaph on it. Ain't nobody gonna bother to read. See, I've watched this film a lot. Now here you come with a whole new set of charts and graphs and records. What you gonna do? Bury them down here with all the other relics of what once was? Let me tell you what else. Yeah, I'll tell you what else. You ain't never gonna figure it out. Just like they never figure out where the stars are, where they're at. It ain't mankind's job to figure that stuff out. So what you're doing is a waste of time, Sarah. And time is all we got left, you know. Well, can't believe I just actually did that. I got a bit carried away. But yeah, maybe it just shows you that I was really into this film. And it's such an epic description of what's happening in the deepening crisis that Romero is exploring in these films. And indeed, what all zombie apocalypse horror is describing, that it really resonates with me. Now, what I found particularly interesting as a non-church-going teenager at the time when I first saw this was the apocalyptic language he uses to describe why God was doing all of this. You know, he starts saying that maybe we're being punished by the Creator. Maybe he didn't want to see us blow ourselves up and make a big hole in the sky. Maybe he wanted to give us a glimpse of what hell was like. Or maybe he was figuring we were getting too big for our britches. Time to figure his shit out. Sorry, that sounded a bit, I don't know, Japanese or something. That was terrible. Anyway, I just remember being fascinated by this angle, and it's certainly an echo of the chilling dialogue from Dawn of the Dead, where a character says, you know, my grandpa used to say, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. When I watched that Dawn of the Dead with my wife once, she's not really a horror fan, but I made her watch that. And, she was like, oh, zombies, fine, you know, it's fun. But when that line came out, I remember her turning to me and said, you know, oh, that's scary. And it's one of the coolest taglines for a movie ever. And the Day of the Dead stuff that I've just mentioned isn't quite as perfect and pithy as that. I guess you couldn't just stick it on a poster. It's a bit long for that. But there's a great sense of metaphysical foreboding about it. It's the same thing, bringing this sort of more like apocalyptic religious background to what might be happening here, this hellish background. In one sense, it's a very old-fashioned view that, you know, bad things will happen when science goes too far. You know, the heart of the Frankenstein story. But on the other, it's Lovecraftian as well, that God or the gods have done this just because we were delving too deep into esoteric knowledge and we have to beware. One of the most talked about characters of Day of the Dead wasn't actually a living person, but it was one of the undead themselves. Dr. Logan's star pupil, a zombie called Bub, who ironically is a little bit more humane than some of his living counterparts. He shows mercy, contemplation, restraint. He doesn't eat Logan's wrist when he brings it near. The scenes where Bub tries on Guardians of the Galaxy style orange foam headphones and salutes and cocks a pistol. At one point, he even opens up a copy of Stephen King's Salem's Lot, but quickly tosses it aside. I'm not sure if that's a reference to the fact that Romero, I think, was down as a possible director for the TV version of Salem's Lot, but didn't do it in the end. I don't know if that's a reference to that or not. Anyway, but these scenes of Bub doing the things he used to do are a nice reminder of the themes that cropped up in the first two movies. Certainly in the second, where zombies wandered like sheep back to the places that mattered to them most, the cathedrals of consumerism, i.e. the shopping mall. But also in the original film Night of the Living Dead, I'm sure there's a moment in that when the main character, the black guy, Ben, I think he's called, he talks about what he's seen out there before he made it to the farmhouse, and he says something like, you know, I saw one of those things sitting behind the wheel of a car as if he was still going somewhere. There's something about this latent humanity of zombies that clearly fascinates Romero, and he brings it into its sharpest focus with Bub, I guess. Having said that, though, while I've heard people rave about Bub and saying he's like one of the best things about the film, I have to disagree. I'm not saying he's not very good, and I think it's an excellent addition in terms of exploring the theme of latent humanity. It's cool, but for me, it's the arguments and conflict between the two human groups, two equally futile approaches to dealing with the hell on earth scenario. That's what, for me, has the lasting impact in Day of the Dead. Now, you can't discuss Day of the Dead without mentioning the effects work by Tom Savini. The stuff he does in this pushes the gore level up 6 notches above Dawn and about 10 notches above Night of the Living Dead. There is something horribly realistic and grim about the gore in Day. I think it was the moment where the zombie leaps up from a gurney and turns to the side only to see his guts and ribcage drop to the floor that my jaw just fell, and I thought as a young teenager watching this, like, holy crap, I've never seen this sort of thing before. In fact, there are some pretty stunning moments of gore in this, and all 3 of the original zombie trilogy have a sort of zombie chowdown sequence, usually, just before the last act of the movie. And Day of the Dead takes this tradition and ups the ante. And, I mean, it ups the ante so much that there's one bit where you see, like, through a sort of viewing window, and there's a blue-lit room, and you see blood squirting on the wall, which is so, like, blatant and big and sort of gruesome. It sort of seems silly and grotesque, and you're like, oh, that's a bit daft. But then straight away you see this image of a zombie chewing entrails through a wire fence that is covered in cobwebs, and you're like, oh, this feels gritty and disgusting. Anyway, we see the zombies attack people in ways that are, for the time, and still are to an extent, horribly realistic and gruesome. But I suppose that, having been round the horror block many times since I was 12 or whatever it was, I saw this, I can't remember when I saw this film, and indeed, after watching many extras and documentaries about how effects are done, then you can watch Day of the Dead and figure out how it was all done, I guess, and thus, yes, it lessens the impact a little bit. But in those early years, when it first came out and I didn't know these techniques, it just sort of blew my mind and felt like a level of technical skill I hadn't seen up until then, or at least not without the same with the same level of brutalness. I think Tom Savini is good at that, of giving a sense of reality to some of the stuff, obviously with his Vietnam background. Another thing to mention is an aspect of the film that has really divided audiences, and that is its score. Romero has a habit of making some unusual choices for the soundtracks to his films. For example, the score to his brilliant vampire movie Martin, love that movie, isn't Hammer Horror orchestral Dracula music, but rather downbeat, moody jazz. The score for Dawn of the Dead is almost wall-to-wall library music, along with some avant-garde prog rock fusion from Goblin and Elevator Muzak. And here, he chooses John Harrison to produce what might be described as a Caribbean-infused bongo-driven synth-pop score. And on paper, you might think, what? You know, not the usual soundtrack for dead people attacking. And I, you know, just look at the horror films that are made today, and I'm quite happy. I enjoy listening to some of the soundtracks. I was listening to the soundtrack to Oculus the other day. Great film, that, by the way. And you know, it's good, and it's a good thing to write to or read scary stuff to. But it it doesn't have the sort of the left field approach that George Romero sometimes takes, and he certainly does that with Day of the Dead. But let me say, I am one of the weirdo trolls that loves Hither's approach to it, and I love the music from Day of the Dead. John Harrison is an underused film composer, and I think his score to the other Romero movie that I love, Creepshow, or one of the others I love, is pretty much a masterpiece. Yeah, I'm saying it. I think Creepshow soundtrack is a masterpiece, and his score to Dawn of the Dead, I guess it's not as varied thematically as Creepshow, but that's fine, because it's, you know, Creepshow is about 5 stories. This one's about 1, so you don't expect millions of different themes. But it's still a brilliant, catchy score with some cracking arrangements and themes. Romero talks about how he listens to this score sometimes in his car, and I have to say, I have listened to this myself, pounding along the road on many occasions. My family are probably sick of listening to The Dead Walk Sweet. Just a heads up, by the way, La La Land Records released a limited edition copy of the entire score for Day of the Dead, including some songs that were included and inspired by the movie, so if you want some bongo-style zombie sounds to match your bongo-inspired Fabio Fritzi Pen Zombie 2 soundtrack, then Day of the Dead is the perfect companion for any beach holiday. Or indeed, underground bunker stay. Actually, I haven't just said that. I wonder if one of the things that works about the score is that it sort of fulfills the same function as the opening sequence, in that the opening and the score evoke a sense of sun, sea, and sand, i.e. the day, but ironically, this is all taking place in the dark ground, like it's mocking them. Like this music and the memories of what happened at the beginning is saying, you know, this is the life you could have had. This is life you want to return to, but you can't. You're stuck down there. Twisted stuff. The ending of Day of the Dead is almost so... hated by various people. And I'm loath to give a spoiler away, but I'm guessing most people would have seen the film already, and if you haven't, then I won't give you too many details. But all I will say is that in some ways it's a happy ending, but is it? You know, the ending either questions the reality of all that's gone before, a sort of was it all a dream idea that we see in Elm Street and Dallas, but I've always considered the possibility that the idea that the ending may be very bleak indeed, and what we're seeing is not some sort of Shangri-La hopefulness, but rather the desperate hopeful firings of a dying brain as the zombie horde take all victims down. You know, that there's flashes of false hope. Now that's a downbeat interpretation of the ending, but it's one I was considering. and of course, maybe the end is like they die and go to heaven or something. Only to find out that heaven's like a lot less busy than they thought. But really, I think there's more of a reasonableness to the idea that maybe the ending is literal, and that the people in question, I won't say who, really do get to where we see. Indeed, at one point in the movie, Dr. Logan makes a pretty startling discovery that people in subsequent horror movies really ought to take note of. He discovered that zombies will actually die naturally as their brain gradually decays and gives an approximate 18-month lifespan on a ghoul. In which case, the best thing humanity can probably do is hold up somewhere nice for a year and a half, read a few books, and relax for a while. And then the real rebuilding of society can take place without the threat of zombie attack. So in some ways, for me, the ending of Day of the Dead makes sense no matter how you view it. And you can make it downbeat, you can make it upbeat. But I'm actually probably more happy to accept the upbeat interpretation. And again, I think it's a really interesting idea that Romero would do that in a film that is so consistently downbeat for the majority of its running time. You know, I've seen TV shows or read books that talk about landmark horror directors, and often they often include John Landis, like he's one of the real masters of horror. Whereas, I'm sorry, like I like John Landis, but he's not really a master of horror. You know, he just made one really good horror movie, The American Werewolf in London, But Romero absolutely deserves his place alongside Cronenberg and Carpenter and Argento as being people who did something unique and interesting with horror and have stayed true to that. Even though, yes, they may have had various misfires, that's all right, you know, can't expect perfection, but they still do interesting things with film, which is why I'm going to be moving on to some even more deeper analysis of Day of the Dead in the next episode. But until then, follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws, or contact me at contactus@theflicksthechurchforgot.com, and certainly if you haven't seen Day of the Dead, get it and watch it, but be braced for a lot of guts. Until next time, don't forget The Flicks The Church Forgot.
They have overrun us, you know. We're in the minority now. Something like 400,000 to one by my calculations. We're in the minority now. We're in the minority now. We're in the minority now.